Here's the title. Alain.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be here. And I had to make a severe selection about what I can present in only 30 minutes. So I obeyed Jason, who sent me a message saying, Alain, I want you to speak about elongated condensates. So I'm going to talk about elongated condensates. What is interesting about elongated condensate, as Maxime Olshany pointed out yesterday night, in theory, in this domain, everything has been done by Jora, and this is not, is Jora here? No? Okay, so you can repeat him, what I said. And this is not an exception. There are two very important papers with Jora, Dima Petrov, and Jörg Walraven, which discuss the properties of elongated condensates. When you have very elongated condensates, you can define two temperatures, the usual critical temperature and a temperature T phi below which the phase coherence extends all over the condensate. But in between, there is an interesting regime where on the one hand it looks like a condensate because density fluctuations are suppressed, but on the other hand it's not really a condensate in the sense that you have axial phase fluctuation. In other words, the coherence length here is smaller than the length of the condensate. You have phase fluctuation from one point to another point of the condensate. So when the length is large enough, this temperature T phi is very smaller, is much smaller than the critical temperature, and you can explore this regime. This regime, the existence of this phase fluctuation were first demonstrated by a very elegant experiment in Hanover. The experiment consists in releasing the condensate and let it expand. And so you observe in the far field regime a conversion of phase fluctuation into intensity fluctuation, just like you have a light beam crossing index of refraction fluctuation, and then you see shades on it. This was semi-quantitative, but it was a very clear evidence of it. Then in Amsterdam, 2 years ago, in an experiment where they use an isofocusing technique, they also demonstrated that you have phase fluctuations in elongated condensates. We decided to try to study carefully and quantitatively the evolution of this phase coherence or this coherence length as a function of the various parameters of the condensate. And for that, we decided to use a method which goes into the Fourier space. In other words, what we decided to do is to study the momentum distribution. The momentum distribution for along the axis here is obviously the Fourier transform of the correlation function. So by observing, for instance, the width of the momentum distribution, we can know whether or not the coherence length is smaller than the total length. If the coherence length is smaller than the total length, then the width of the momentum distribution should be larger than h bar over L. Okay? This, of course, for an optician, we are optician, for optician is quite trivial. It reminds us of the fact that when you want to make the analysis of light, you can either do usual spectroscopy, that is to say, study the distribution of intensity versus frequency, or go into the Fourier space and study and do Fourier transform spectroscopy. And you can select the method as you want as a function of the experimental difficulties. And here, of course, what we understand very easily is that this method will be interesting when the coherence length is small enough that the width of the momentum spectrum is broad, so it will be, between quotes, easy to do the experiment. How can we study the distribution of momentum in the Bose-Einstein condensate? Well, in theory, everything has been done by Jora, and in experiment, everything has been done by Ketterle. So what we are going to do, I'm sorry if some people disagree. Yeah. And here, what we use is Bragg spectroscopy, which has been demonstrated first by Wolfgang Ketterle in MIT and also in Bill Phillips' group, and used in a nice way by Neil Davidson in the Weizmann Institute. And the idea is the following. I have two counter-propagating laser beams with detuning between this one and this one, and I make a transition by absorbing one photon and re-emitting and having stimulated emission of another photon in the other wave. This is a coherent process which will transfer atoms from one given momentum to another momentum. In other words, you add 2 h bar k of momentum to the photon. And it's not difficult by looking at energy and momentum conservation to find out that, in fact, this process is narrow resonance. So you have resonant outcoupling of atoms with a well-defined value of the momentum in the condensate. And this value of the momentum is strictly related to the detuning between the two laser waves. So for a given detuning that you choose here, you select a precise value of the component. So here is the result of such a transfer. And you have the outcoupled atoms, which were in the condensate at this value of the momentum. Now, by scanning delta, you can look at the fraction of atoms which are extracted and reconstruct the momentum distribution. I like also the other interpretation, the interpretation of optics people. When you look at these two laser waves, you make a grating. This grating is moving, and so you will have Bragg diffraction of the matter waves on this diffraction grating, and the matter wave that will be diffracted are the one where the de Broglie wavelength exactly matches the periodicity of the sliding grating here. That's of course the same thing, it's just wave particle duality. Okay, so let's go to the experiment. In our lab, we have iron core electromagnets which allow us to make condensate which are very elongated. The ratio of the long dimension to the small dimension is 150. And if you want to know how I call this ratio, I call it anisotropy ratio, not the aspect ratio like other people do. This is just to wake you up. The problem in doing Bragg spectroscopy with an elongated condensate that we met is the following. The mean free pass for atom moving in the condensate is much smaller than the length of the condensate. That means that when you try to extract atoms out of the condensate, you will have collisions and you cannot do a nice experiment. If you do it transversely, no problem. But what we want to do is to make the analysis along the axis of the condensate. To overcome this problem, what we do is that we switch off the trap and we let the condensate expand for a small time, only 2 milliseconds. In this small time, basically nothing changes along the axis of the condensate, but radially it expands by a factor of 10 so that the density decreases by 2 orders of magnitude. And the density increases enough that there are no more collisions. And it's not difficult to convince yourself that nothing changes along the axis, so the measurement that we are going to do here are equivalent to momentum measurement you would do here. Of course, there is a supplementary experimental problem that you met here. You have a very large velocity of expansion radially. And that means that if your laser beam here are not exactly orthogonal to this expansion, then what you are going to measure is the Doppler effect of the flying atoms and not what you try to observe. But okay, you have to be careful, just to say that the experiment was not easy. The experiment was not easy also for the following reason. When you put the number to find out what kind of accuracy you must have for the difference in frequency between the two counterpropagating laser beam, you find that you would like at least to have a jitter in the frequency difference less than 100 Hertz. You may say, well, 100 Hertz is a lot. Not at all. 100 Hertz on optical frequencies is really very small. Remember that optical frequencies are in the range of 10 to the 15th. Okay, so 100 compared to 10 to the 15th is a lot. So we use plenty of tricks, and basically the idea that you want the two laser beams to follow exactly the same path to avoid any fluctuation. And there is only a last mirror, which is very critical. And I don't want to go into details, but in order to implement the tricks, it turns out that what we are making is not one sliding grating, but we do two opposite sliding grating. That means in one experiment, what we do is that we simultaneously extract atoms with momentum plus p and atoms with minus p. And you, as you see, this is a real experiment. It's not an artist view, it's a real experiment. So you see that you extract atoms at plus p and atoms at minus p. So you do twice in a same experiment. Okay, so what you do, you select the tuning, measure how many atoms are extracted, change the tuning, measure how many atoms are extracted. It's a long experiment, and you plot a momentum spectrum like this one, and you see you have a nice resolution, and you say very nice, and then you begin to plot the width versus the temperature. And what you expect is that the width should increase when temperature increases, because when temperature increases, the phase fluctuation increases, or more precisely, the correlation length decreases. So you have a trend, you are happy, but you are not happy at all because there is a large dispersion in the results. It's such a difficult experiment that it is no wonder. But anyway, you say, what can we do? Well, what you can do is what experimentalists do. Try to make a smart process of averaging. And we found a way of averaging which turned out to be very beautiful. Starting from many spectra like that, look at what we find for a temperature of 100 nano-K, a beautiful profile with a nice signal-to-noise ratio. At a higher temperature, we have also a very beautiful profile. So now we can really safely study how the width evolves with the temperature. But the signal-to-noise ratio is also good enough that there is another quantity that we can study safely. It is the shape of the profile, and the shape of the profiles is a very interesting quantity. And for old spectroscopists like me, it's clear that a profile like that is a Lorentzian. For young students, they don't trust me, so what they do is that they fit it with various shapes and they look at the residual. And here are the residual for a Lorentzian, here are the residual for a Gaussian, and so the student come back and say, you are good for fitting curves with your eye. Okay. So, the fact that it is Lorentzian is very important from a theoretical point of view, because for phase fluctuating condensate, you can demonstrate that the coherence function as an exponential decay, and of course it's clear that the Fourier transform should be a Lorentzian. While if the coherence length would, or if the correlation function width would be dominated just by the autocorrelation of the density profile, it would be basically a Gaussian. So the fact that it is a Lorentzian and not a Gaussian is very relevant. Now, we want also to look if the evolution of the width versus the parameters of the condensate agrees with theory. And for that, we have to know exactly what theory says. Theory says that the width should vary proportionally to a certain quantity which scales as the temperature and scales as the inverse of the one-dimensional density at the center of the condensate. And it is convenient to define a certain quantity here, you put the right constant here. If you don't know exactly what constant to do, you go and see Jora, and Jora will give you exactly the correct factor, prefactor, and everything. And finally, you can put the theoretical prediction in the following shape. What you expect is proportional to a quantity, which is a relevant quantity, which depends only on temperature, one-dimensional density at the center of a condensate, and the prefactor here comes from the fact that your correlation function has to be average over the whole condensate. And of course, the density is not uniform, so you must do some kind of averaging, either by very sophisticated theoretical process or just by a local density approximation. It turns out that a local density approximation is very good, provided that the coherence length is significantly smaller than the size of the condensate. So what we are going to do is the following thing. We are going to measure the temperature, measure the one-dimensional density at the center of the condensate. We can calculate this quantity, we measure that one, and we compare the two. So this, what I say here, I was anticipating over this transparency. So we measure the width, we measure the density, we measure the temperature, and we plot this versus a certain relevant quantity. Before showing you the plot, I have to warn you that it is not as simple, because in fact, the width that we are measuring is not very large compared to our experimental resolution. So in fact, we have to make some kind of deconvolution. And for doing a deconvolution, we must make an assumption. The assumption that we make is that the resolution function is a Gaussian, which is a reasonable assumption. And then what we expect is to find the profile, which is a convolution of a Gaussian by Lorentzian, the so-called void profile, well known by spectroscopists. And so we have a formula. So in this formula, what we have is the width of the void profile expressed as a function of the width of the Gaussian resolution function and the width of the Lorentzian, which is the signal you are looking for. So what we are going to do is to plot this quantity versus the delta nu phi, which is a parameter that we calculate as a function of the measured density and temperature. And we will make a fit with only two free parameters, alpha, which is just a scaling parameter, and here the width of the resolution function that we know in fact, but we let it free, we let it free for the fit. And when we do that, this is the width that we measure. This is a quantity relevant to theory that we calculate for each of the spectra. And it is a fit, and the fit gives you the resolution function, which is an excellent agreement with what we had measured. And it gives us the constant alpha, which, according to theory, should be 0.77. And we find an excellent agreement. The reason why we give two different uncertainties here, one is the statistical uncertainty, and the other one is unknown calibration factors. Okay, it's different in nature. Okay, so you see that you have a very convincing result, and we can say that good for Jora. Your theory is good, Jora. Another way to express the result is to plot the ratio of the coherence length divided by the total length versus the ratio of T to the famous T phi. And you see that we have explored everything in a range where the coherence length is significantly smaller than the total length, because the ratio is between 1 over 5 to 1 over 30 or something like that, okay? And we see an excellent agreement. Now, of course, we would like to investigate the crossover region, the region where the temperature becomes close to T phi, that is to say, the region where the coherence evolves and develops along the whole condensate. And this we cannot do by the momentum spectroscopy measurement because our resolution function is too broad. We don't have a resolution good enough in momentum. So of course the natural reaction is to go to the Fourier space and to say, okay, we are going to make atom interferometry. So we start from the condensate, we make two copies, and we look at the visibility of the fringes versus the separation. And this, of course, amounts to measuring directly the correlation function for the profile, for the wave function of the condensate. Such experiments, of course, have been done also. Always the same people, you see, Ketterle, Bill Phillips, and also in Ench's group in Munich. And these people have used this method to demonstrate that in usual condensate, yes, indeed, the coherence, the phase coherence extends over the whole condensate. This method has also been used by our colleagues in Hanover, in Enmer's group, to explore the regime similar to ours, that is to say, the regime where the coherence length is small compared to the size. We would like to use it to explore the crossover region. And when we did this experiment, so you see, you start with a condensate and you split in two, and then here you do an interferometric measurement and you have one output of the interferometer, the other output of the interferometer, and you see indeed beautiful fringe is developing. And when the student processed this figure, when they plot the visibility of the fringes versus separation, it decays as expected, and when you look at the decay length, you find that it goes well as a function of the temperature. So everything is fine, except that there is a slight problem. The problem is the following. Here, I have an enlargement of one of these figures. And when, on this interferometry figure here, you see that the trace of the two condensates are the two disks here. And for any reasonable explanation of fringes, you expect to see fringes here. And in fact, we see many fringes out of the overlap of the two copies of the condensate. So I don't want to present the result of this experiment because I certainly do not trust a measurement of visibility of fringes that I do not understand. We have done our best to try to understand these fringes. At the moment, we don't understand them, and I would be happy to discuss this with people.
That means the phase coherence established very quickly? Is that
what? No, that means that here, as a naive optician, I cannot understand how you can have fringes where you don't have overlap between two beams. So there must be some extra beam somewhere. Maybe the best guess is that this beam is produced by some kind of nonlinear effect, but I have not found any nonlinear effect at lower. At my level of understanding, I don't find any nonlinear effect that can produce the second. Here, according to a naive analysis, there is only one beam. You cannot observe fringes with only one beam. You must have two beams. So this is a mystery. Of course, we will solve it one day, but if I can get help here, I will be happy.
Right.
Yep.
Can we go back this way?
Sure.
Could you help me understand the fringes that should be there? Why isn't that just all black or all white?
Here, you see, Eric, you make, it's a pi over 2 pulse here, so you make two copies. So, of course, and now you recombine two waves going this direction and two waves going this direction.
And what is the physical significance of the spacing of the fringe?
Oh, the spacing of the fringe? Well, of course, this, I get this out of my time of question, right, Chairman? Okay. The most naive analysis of this interferometer tells you you are going to have uniform, and then it would change with the visibility, with the phase difference. But what you have here, in addition, is that you have expansion of the condensate. And expansion of the condensate means a parabolic phase profile. And the difference between two parabola is a linear phase difference. And this is the reason for this linear fringes. Okay? So, and then the signification for the spacing of these fringes is just inversely proportional to the separation to the two, as expected. Okay, but the point is that, but of course we have to discuss it with a piece of paper on the blackboard, how can you find extra beams to understand that out of this overlap you still have fringes here. And when you look at some published paper, for instance, Bill Phillips' NIST paper, where they have measured the coherence, when you look carefully, there is something similar. They don't comment on it, but when you look carefully at the published paper, there is something similar. Fringes that should not be there. So I would like to understand them. And it's especially interesting because when we measure the visibility of all the fringes, then the result scales as predicted by theory. So it seems that these fringes mean something. We would like to know exactly where they come from. Okay, enough for that. In the 10 minutes which are left, I would like to discuss very recent measurements, really preliminary results. It's not yesterday night that I discussed it with my student, but it's last week, okay? And the question is, how do these condensates grow? And of course, I have to remind you, theory, again, Jorah. There is a paper by Kagan, Svistunov, and Shlapnikov telling you that Bose-Einstein condensate should grow in two stages. First, a kinetic stage where you build a macroscopic population in the lowest state, in the lowest levels of the trap, and then you have suppression of density fluctuations, but you still have phase fluctuation. And if I am correct, it is in this paper that the notion of quasi-condensate was introduced for the first time. And then this phase fluctuation should progressively disappear and the phase coherence should develop across the whole condensate. There is another important reference or a series of paper by Gardiner and collaborator where they find an analytic expression for the growth of the condensed fraction. That is to say, only the population, okay, the condensed fraction. They don't address the equation of the phase fluctuation. Now, what about experiments? Again, Keterle's group, 98. Then in Ench's group in Munich, they have studied the growth of condensed fraction and they found that it is in agreement with Gardiner's prediction. There is the experiment of Amsterdam where they studied both and they have a hint that there may be a delay for the establishment of coherence. Jörg will tell us, if I understand correctly, that do you claim that there was first a quasi-condensate? Well, we can discuss that later. Anyway, this is an interesting paper to study the intermediate, the growth of the condensate. The point is that for the growth of the population, it's clear that there is an agreement between various experiments and Gardiner's equation. The question of how the phase coherence develops over the condensate is still an open question. So what we decided to do is to try to study it with our black spectroscopy measurement. So what we do is the following thing. We start from a thermal cloud just above the critical temperature. Then we suddenly lower the radio frequency knives, which is used for evaporative cooling. So we will truncate the Boltzmann distribution to a height which is 3 times kT, where T is the temperature. So you see, this is a plot of what happens for the trap depth. So suddenly the knife is lower to this value. And then this is what we observe. We see that the temperature rapidly decreases and go to a steady state value. We see that the condensate fraction grows with an initial delay. And we are going, I will show you in another plot, to study how the momentum distribution width evolves with time. And I must point out that these experiments have been done with an elongated condensate with an anisotropy ratio of 100. Yeah. So, first, condensed fraction. This is a series of data taken with different initial number of atoms. So this is a smaller number and here a bigger number, and you see characteristic curves with an initial delay and then an exponential here, and this can be fitted with a curve according to Gardiner's equation. And well, I cannot be too definitive on that, but the constants that we extract here seem to agree quite well with the evaluation, with what you can extract from Gardiner's paper. Okay. Now, so this is for the condensate growth. Now, let's go to the width of the Bragg spectrum, so the width of the momentum distribution. You see that the width of the momentum distribution is first large, and then it decays when the condensed fraction is growing. So you may say, great, it means that at the beginning the current length is very small and then it extends, and so we have the famous intermediate regime predicted by Jora and his co-authors. In fact, you have to be a little more cautious, because for each value of the condensed fraction you have a distribution which is expected in the steady state regime. So what you must do is compare the width that you measure to the width that you should have for this condensed fraction at this temperature. And when you do that, sorry to disappoint you, Jora, but when you do that, all the points are close to one. And you don't see any particular trend to have a broader thing at the in the beginning. Of course, our time resolution may not be good enough to observe interesting things happening here, but this is a result. You may ask a question, why is it that we don't find exactly one? Why is it that there is this trend to be larger than one? Well, our explanation is that there is, as was nicely demonstrated in Amsterdam, when you have a shock cooling of a condensate, especially for elongated condensate, you trigger quadrupole oscillation, breathing modes. And this, of course, provokes a broadening of the momentum spectrum. So here is a spectacular example of that. If you start with a large number of atoms, you have large amplitude quadrupole oscillation. The result presented here.
But that's not during growth. That oscillation is when it settles down, right?
Yes, but you know, this is a growth. So it's the same time scale. So you have the growth and you have this oscillation. Now, the point is that for this data, we don't observe this oscillation because we start from a much lower number of atoms, so it's not deep cooling, it's just cooling at the limit of the critical temperature, so we don't observe spectacular oscillation. But there may be remaining oscillations that we cannot observe because our signal-to-noise ratio is not good enough, which would be an explanation for this extra width. We have to do further studies. I have a couple of other transparencies. This one is just to stimulate a discussion with Alan. You see that we have oscillation not only for the condensed fraction but also for the thermal cloud, and I am sure that you can help us to find out if there is something interesting in this kind of pictures. Next week we will have plenty of time to discuss this kind of thing.
We share a lot.
Yep. So, conclusion. There is still a lot to be done. Of course, I expect a lot of discussion with people about suggestion. And of course, very important, who are the people who have done all these experiments? So I'm here presenting only a part of the people working for me. It's a so-called elongated BEC team. Bright people are responsible for the results that I presented in the first part. Now they have left. Fabrice Gerbier is now with Emmanuel Bloch in Germany. Simon Richard has not yet decided what he is going to do. He's looking for a job, but doesn't know exactly what kind of job, so hard for me to help him. And Joseph Thewison has found a position in Toronto in the same department as Alan Griffin. This is a present team, Mathilde Hugbach, Jocelyn Retter, who is a postdoc from UK, and Andres Varon, who is a PhD student from Colombia, and of course, the boss, Philippe Bouillet, who is here. And I have a last experimental result. The last experimental result is the effect of the boss on the team. Here you have the team. This is Mathilde, Jocelyn, and Andres. And they are very happy seeing the quasi-condensate grow, okay? And look what happens when the boss comes in the lab. They become very serious. So with this last experimental result, I thank you for your attention. Except what?
Should I expect to see oscillations in your excess, you have excess decoherence, if you like, or excess?
Yes, it seems that if we can, if the experiment is stable enough, we should see the breathing also on the momentum width. But you realize that it is a delicate experiment, but these people are good, and I expect they will do it. Yes, Philippe? Yes.
The main problem is that you don't know how to mine.
Yes.
And then the delay triggers.
Yes.
You're not sure when you trigger the oscillation.
So I'm going to pay whoever I have to pay and ask the second question, which is, I think there's a great need for thermometry that continues when the temperature is below something like the chemical potential, where we can't see the thermal skirt anymore. But if I understand right, at least in the regime you are operating now, your instrumental resolution is such that you can't necessarily go to much lower temperatures. Is that something you could re-optimize?
Yeah, well, I think that the method we are trying to use, that is the interferometry, is the right way of doing it. We all understand that. When we are limited by resolution in a given variable, then we go to the Fourier space, and it should be easy on the other one. So yes, this is what we try to do. And another point, maybe according to these last results about the growth of the condensate. It turns out that we are doing these experiments in the elongated regime because the experiment is set for that. We master the experiment in this configuration. But I don't know what is Jorah's opinion, but it seems to me that probably it would be a better idea to try to observe the onset of condensation with a condensate which is much less elongated. And then the momentum spectroscopy should be nice. In addition, if I understand well the paper of Amsterdam, it's less likely to have this deep, the excitation of this deep breathing mode. So I think that on the last part of the talk, it's just, as I said, preliminary result. I think that we definitely have to change the parameter of the experiment, go to a much more isotropic condensate, and then look what happens here. And then it seems that our method of Bragg spectroscopy, because it will be smaller size, so our resolution should be good enough to observe what happens.
Alain. And in the case where you observe the development, the growth of a condensate, and you say that the phase coherence more or less changes on the same time scale.
Yes. This curve, yes.
As the boson-condensate grows.
Yes.
What is the equilibrium state for these conditions? Is it already quasi-condensate with phase coherence length much smaller than
Jorah, the... you are the one to answer this question. I mean, you are asking a question to an experimentalist. What I can say as an experimentalist is that everything happens as if the width of the momentum distribution would correspond to the steady state associated to this number of condensed atoms and the temperature that we measure. So it looks as if it corresponds to the steady state for these numbers. But I don't know what the theorist says about that.
Before presenting these data on the condensate growth, you nicely explained us how you judge whether the equilibrium sample is,
yes,
is a true condensate or quasi-condensate.
Yes. So we calculate the steady-state width with the same formula that we have checked to be correct in the steady-state. So that's what I can say. I use alpha equals 0.67, etc. So I use the formula that we have checked to be correct in the steady-state to normalize this measured width at the idea. And the result is a red curve here.
I have several questions, but we can discuss those in our office. But if you could show me Gardner's or your plots of the growth expansion, I think it's always a problem if you get quite good agreement with an incorrect theory. I'm sure you've been, as you said, a whole series of papers, but I think the last, there's not enough experiments. I mean, it's very nice to do experiments, but the last development of Gardner's work, which was also agreed with work of Zaremba, Bilsma, and Stoff, found that this sort of simple formula there, which was the initial attempt, was considerably modified, unfortunately, and didn't agree as well as this incorrect formula did with the original MIT data. So it'd be nice, certainly, to have more experimental studies, but...
And it will be nice...
But you should use the latest version of this theory rather than the initial version.
Okay, again, this is preliminary results, and we will have more discussion next week, and...
It's been very puzzling why experimentalists have not done these experiments since the original
MIT. This is the very raw analysis with just an experimental growth, We have one preliminary comparison
with
the full theory of Gardner,
and you know the paper by Bilsma.
We know that we have to do it, but
you know the paper by Bilsma, Zaremba.
It's not agreeing as well as the one.
Yes. I have a point on the dependence on the number of atoms, because if you have a large number of atoms, then your sample becomes hydrodynamic in the actual
direction. Yes, we are totally hydrodynamic, yes.
And that means that your your condensation can become local. You develop temperature gradients.
Yes.
Yes. So if you want to compare with the theory, there's two limits. There's the very low density limit, where you first have to bring all your particles to the center of the trap and your condensate will grow. Or there is the hydrodynamic limit in which you will have a distribution. Under those conditions, it's extremely difficult to grow your condensate without the presence of temperature gradients in the system. And my question is, did you try to shake it hard in order to look for those temperature gradients?
No, what we have done, again, this is really a preliminary result. And in addition, I have to admit that last week something happened, which happens every other year, which is no more rubidium in the experiment. And so we had to stop, and it's another 2 or 3 weeks until the experiment was going. What I can say is that when we calculate the local temperature after this shock cooling, in the regime where we see the broad oscillation, just follow your analysis, we calculate the ratio between the local temperature and the critical temperature. And in the regime where we have this big oscillation, this ratio is below 1 on a long, long range in the condensate. But in the experiment I am presenting here, which corresponds to this value of this one, small number of atoms, then the shock coolings initially, if we do the calculation well, makes the local temperature go below the critical temperature only at the center of the condensate. So, and then we don't see visible oscillation with our signal-to-noise ratio. So that may be another way, but I fully agree that we have a major problem. But again, I expect from discussion I will have here that we will make, we'll have a clear strategy on should we continue with this experiment with very elongated condensate, or should we change the experiment to a configuration with a much more spherical condensate. The important point is that we have demonstrated that our technique allows us to make this measurement of width during the growth of the condensate, and this is good news, and now we have to decide what strategy we are going to follow.
So Alan, is it possible to use the Bragg spectroscopy as a means of cooling?
The question is it possible to use a Bragg spectroscopy as a means of cooling? Why?
Like evaporation. Well, cooling at temperatures lower than when temperatures...
No, but I think the what would be the advantage compared to the radiofrequency knife? The radiofrequency knife is really versatile.
But then you get rid of excitations which are really of the order of H bar omega Z energy, H bar omega Z. Resolve.
Okay, that's an interesting suggestion. I have to think, we have to talk more. Okay.
Give the last word this time. Eric.
Yeah, okay.
Could we look at the slide where we see the damping of the long oscillations? My understanding is that this mode is not actually fundamentally different, mode from, yes, exactly. It's not really a different mode from the phase fluctuations. It's just sort of the lowest order mode of the phase fluctuation. And I asked, I believe it was Jora, of all people, how to understand the time constant for this damping. And he said, well, it's Landau damping, and so it should be linear in K. I can see just reading off of your graph there that mode damps in 400 milliseconds. If I go to a mode which has a much shorter wavelength and to which you're now sensitive in your Bragg spectroscopy, you could easily come up with an estimate of that damping time as well. Perhaps it's just simply shorter than 20 milliseconds or something like that.
Okay.
Is this in a hydrodynamic region?
We are in hydrodynamic region.
So Landau damping is not relevant to the hydrodynamic region. This would be viscosity and thermal conductivity. You know,
we are 10 times...
There is damping of the lowest excitations in the hydrodynamic region and of higher excitations. Simply the expressions are different from the polynomial region. But the damping is present.
It's not Landau.
But I think
but it doesn't matter.
For the wavelengths of fluctuations that I land, you can see that's a much shorter wavelength than I expect it is in the non-hydrodynamic region, with a very simple expression.
Okay, I'm sure I have to learn a lot. This is why I'm happy to be here, because I have to learn these kind of things. And the only point I can say is that we are definitely in the hydrodynamic regime 10 times less than you were in Amsterdam. That is the ratio of the mean free pass to the length in the thermal cloud is like a factor of 10 or something. And you had, I think, a factor of 100, right, if I am correct. So we are 10 times less, but we are definitely in the hydrodynamic regime anyway.
Okay, I think this is where we should call a halt for the discussion right now.
Thank you.
Thank Alain once more.